We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
You think football is still fun?
Yes.
Sir?
Yes, no.
No?
Sir, it was fun.
Not anymore, though, is it? Is it?
No, not right now.
No, it's not fun anymore, not even a little bit.
Just look at that, he hit the fall. Guy gets a free steak. You having fun yet?
Oh, yeah, I'm having a blast, thanks.
Good.
All right, welcome back to Big Screen Sports, a podcast where all movies are sports movies. I am your host, Kyle Bandujo, and today we have another movie selected by our Big Screen Sports Patreon group. They got timely. We've got, you know, listening to this episode, the Masters will have just concluded, and so our Big Screen Sports Patreon group picked Caddyshack, had Caroline on the pod for that one, and had the great Spencer Hall returning for that. Spencer, Caddyshack is one of his all-time favorites. We were very fortunate to have him. Had him for a little time shortened, so on the back half, it's going to be just me and Caroline, but a lot of dynamite, incredible drop-ins from Spencer. If you are not subscribe to his Channel 6 newsletter or the Shutdown Fullcast, you are doing yourself a disservice to do that. And also, if you want a little more from Spencer, he gave me some great stuff on Caddyshack for my book, Movies with Balls, The Greatest Sports Films of All Time, Analyzed, Mapped, and Illustrated. That is available wherever books are sold. So you can pre-order that. It comes out in September. But I do want to thank our Big Screen Sports Patreon group for voting in this movie. One of my favorites, especially our Big Chill producer-level patrons. That is Aaron Figueroa, Mike Schubert, Steve Rogers, Kevin Frost, Mike D, Ryan Yeager, Mike Dries, Chris Mikoski, John Crick, Sam Smith, Zachary's, Class Same Fire, Jason Alva, Steve Nabo, Dan McFall, Kevin Inkman, Mac Lindsay, Kurt Ritchie, Robert Dove, Andrew Teagle, Benjamin Bauman, Jeff Esses, Anthony Scafone, Taylor Logan, Sean Hoffman, and Hamilton B. Ergler. Big thanks to them and all of our patrons for supporting this show. If you want to support this show and you want to have a say in what movies are going to be picked, we've got a great theme month coming up in May, so you can go get some votes in for that. You can go to patreon.com/bigscreensports. We really appreciate all of our patrons for keeping this thing going. And without further ado, let's talk Caddyshack with me, Caroline Darney, and Spencer Hall. All right, returning to Big Screen Sports, my co-host from For the Water Cooler, Caroline Darney. Caroline, how are you?
Hello, hi. Good.
And then also making what should be a triumphant return. We've not seen him on the show since the season one finale of Ted Lasso, which feels like 400 years ago, from the Shutdown Fullcast and Channel 6, the great Spencer Hall. Spencer, thank you so much for returning to the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm psyched. Spencer, I would say what's going on at the Fullcast, but that's just a lot. Channel 6, tell the folks about it.
It's our newsletter. We do it two things a week. If you subscribe, you get quality content. Like tomorrow, we're doing the Big Ten vibe check. Just let everybody know how everyone in the Big Ten's feeling about their football programs. I just got done with the Michigan State entry, so I'm trying to cheer myself up.
Not great, Bob.
It's going to get better.
Just
not great,
the dumb bitch bracket.
Which just the dumb bitch bracket. We're working our way through the dumb bitches of history. Just the dumbest, worst people. All right. You can't just be evil. You got to be like evil and stupid. And fortunately, some of the most important people in history were real evil and real stupid.
It's been a true delight to follow along. Caroline, what's going on at For the Water Cooler?
Let's see. What did we? I have finally, after eight and a half days of real lifetime, finished all of 24.
You texted Ryan and I at like 8 o'clock in the morning, my time, to announce that you had finished 24, which is a real. You've been live texting You've been live texting 24 to Ryan and I for the past couple weeks. I have never seen any 24. Ryan has, but I have
should
not.
Should have been a paid subscription. I'm just giving it away for free. Matt and I talked about Legend of Zelda video games on the pod this week, this past week. And next week, or when you hear this, well, our upcoming guest will be Anish Shroff from ESPN. Does football and lacrosse and all sorts of good stuff. One of my good friends. So not sure yet what the topic's going to be. But I should probably text him and find out. So, yeah, all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, I want to lodge a formal complaint that the two hardest rounds of trivia on your show, the only ones that I have not done well at were the ones where I was on the show. All the others, I'll listen and be like, I would kill this. I know all these answers. And when I was on the show, Matt just asked me questions about ABBA, of which I knew. I found out I know very little to nothing about ABBA, which was very disappointing.
Yeah, I blew it this week. My so-called life. Damn.
No. But. Yeah. So I haven't listened yet. I would have whiffed on that too. Yeah. A little promotion, a little podcast business of my note. You can pre-order my book, Movies with Balls, the greatest sports films of all time, analyzed, mapped, and illustrated now wherever books are sold. My Spencer here helped me out with the movie we're talking about tonight. And Caroline for months thought I was writing a children's book.
Dead.
So that was so that was fun. So yeah, go pre-order that where all books are sold. But Spencer helped me out with the movie that we're doing tonight that was voted in to be covered on the show by our Big Screen Sports Patreon group. Tonight we are talking about Caddyshack, the 1980 golf comedy. An exclusive golf course has to deal with a flat-tailed new member and a destructive dancing gopher. It stars Chevy Chase, Rodney Dangerfield, Bill Murray, and Michael O'Keefe. Directed by Harold Ramis, written by Ramis, Brian Doyle Murray, and Douglas Kenny. Got a 72% on Rotten Tomato. And Caroline, I want to kick it to you first because this was a first time watch for you, and I'm just looking for early impressions.
What was happening most of the time? I told Kyle first, and I tweeted this morning, so this is my defense. I've been in a cranky mood today, so I think there's a few things that probably would have hit, like laughed harder. I definitely had several laugh out loud moments. It was funny. It was 90 minutes, you know, it goes, it's all over the place. And again, Spencer told me that there was no script, which makes a lot of things come back together for me. But it was very 1980 and I enjoyed it. It is it one that I'll throw on all the time and watch over and over again and quote every time? Probably not, but I enjoyed it. It was fun.
Now, Spencer, I reached out to you when I was writing my book because you have publicly stated some love for this movie many a time as a great commentary on this country club culture, America in general. Why does this movie resonate for you 44 years later?
It resonates for me because this is a film about class, and there really aren't a whole lot of movies American movies that directly tackle class head on in a way that is hostile. A lot of the time there will be like a sort of wink and nod about it. Sometimes you get this in things like I'm trying to think of My Fair Lady style stories where Pretty Woman, right? Where, oh, we have this woman from the streets, right? And now she's whisked into upper society. And it turns out that, like, you know, aha, she belonged there all along. And that's, I'm simplifying Pretty Woman, sorry. But the idea behind Caddyshack is that Danny sees this. It's what he wants. It's what he's working to infiltrate as somebody who wants to get out of the situation they're in. And then he sees it and ultimately decides the only solution he has is to destroy it. That's it. The message of Caddyshack is you should blow up the golf course. That's the answer. The people who are born into it hate it. The only ones who thrive are idiots or sadists. Like, at the center, I mean, Ted Knight does a beautiful job as Judge Smales. He's hilarious. However, Judge Smales is a sadist. He says at one point in the show, like in the movie, he says, I've sent boys younger than you to the gas chamber or to the chair. He goes, didn't want to do it. I felt I owed it to them. Do you see a better distillation of like every prosecutor you've ever met, right? Than that, well, the law may be wrong and cruel, but I owe it to send someone to the chair. Like that's, that to me, Caddyshack's message I know some people might think it's nihilist. I'm like, no, 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 no. They think you should kill those people. They think you should blow it up because there's nothing there.
I mean, Judge Smales is exactly the kind of person who is on Trump's Project 2025 committee or whatever they've got going on right now. Like, exactly the type would fit in perfectly with that crowd.
Right. Al Cherevic is the guy who would vote for Trump only because it was, like, politically expedient to him. He'd be like, yeah, that guy's terrible. By the way, I'm rich and all these people hate me. That's it. Like, that's the only rich guy who's having fun is the one that all of the rich people despise. Like, they absolutely hate him.
There's just something absolutely hilarious about the shot where he starts playing the music and they like can't, like, they're talking, the judge is in the forefront and they're in the background and everyone's just like doing like, wacky 70s dances as it's like Kenny Loggins hits and stuff. Like,
they're playing, I think the song they're playing is Any Way You Want It by Journey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. That is correct. Yeah. Oh man. I actually like that got a laugh out loud. I don't know why. It was just so absurd. Like, that was
Dangerfield's dancing and dance face, both in that scene and in the stuffy dinner scene, is just, the man was great at physical comedy in general. Like, he knew how to leverage his strange look into getting laughs.
Yes.
Yeah. And also has some of the best lines in the film, which he delivers with zero subtlety. It's great. They're so over the top, right? Like, last time I saw a mouth like that, it had a hook in it.
The entire boat scene, like, you say I almost got head from Amelia Earhart. Is that did I catch that?
Yep.
Was that
you did the thing about I know why tigers eat their young
is dark incredible joke. That's a grim joke, and it's delivered with such sanguinity, just so cheerful. Like, oh, now I know why tigers eat their young. Biggest waste of prime real estate in the United States. Graveyards and golf courses. Or cemeteries and golf courses.
It's, yeah, like, nobody wants to
pave them. Just pave them.
Al Cherevic and Malcolm Gladwell handshaking on that one about golf courses.
But he's still playing. He's still playing.
He is absolutely still. Well, again, because that is the rich, the whole rich thing is do as I say, not as I do, but not in an endearing way. It's like, I will do all the things that are bad for other people. I will take government welfare, but you cannot, person who desperately needs it. That would be socialism.
Right. And no one's loyal to it. Like, no one. Like, the delightfully named Lacey Underalls, right? Brings Danny into the house for some, like ass, right? And get some ass. That's the best way I know how to put it, because it's Caddyshack. You're like, that's not a love scene. That's just two people getting some ass. And but she's not loyal to it. She brings Danny in and just uses him. She's just negligent, right? She's just like, oh, whatever. Like, I won't think about doing this at the house I'm a guest at and staying at, right? Won't ask anybody.
There's got to be a million rooms in that house.
Got to be, but nope, doesn't care, right? Doesn't matter to her, right? Because she has a certain zest for living, Judge Smales says. It's great. It's great because all of that is true, and this film still loves golf. Like, this film, obviously, everyone still really likes the game. And I enjoy that at the end, that's still present. Like, they're like, yeah, this is an absolute, the country club's an absolutely terrible place. Really like to go out for nine holes right now. Like, that's, you get the feeling that everyone in the film actually genuinely likes golf.
And I actually kind of, between that and the Masters starting, and we're helping out with the, there's Chris Long's doing his charity golf event in Charlottesville in a week or so. I'm like, I watched it and I was like, man, I kind of want to go golf.
Right.
I know, okay, this isn't the message of the movie, but like,
it's a sign of a good golf movie is if it makes you want to go golf.
Caroline, there's this great, like, quote from a French film theorist that says that every movie has 5 minutes of beauty, accidental or not. Is the opening sequence with the vocals from I'm All Right and the sprinklers going off, it's kind of beautiful.
It is. I mean, look, I went with, I made Kirsch go to see Kenny Loggins with me in DC. And actually, Kyle, we were doing the podcast. I think it was the Top Gun podcast.
We were doing the Top Gun podcast. It was you, me, and Ryan doing the Top Gun podcast.
As the show is devolving at the end, as it does, Ryan looks up and sees that Kenny Loggins is coming to DC. And so he's like, Carolyn, you got to go. I buy tickets like while we're recording. And so I was like, I had these two tickets. And he was like, the funniest person you can take is Alex Kirshner. So I take Kirsch and we go. And so as we're walking in, Kirsch and his like totally endearing self is like, are we here to enjoy it? Like, is this like, we're excited about this? Or are we here like to kind of laugh at it? Like, where are our vibes? Like, I want to match you where you're at, which I thought was just like the nicest thing ever. But I was like, I think a little bit of both. Like, I'm kind of excited, but like, it's fucking Kenny Loggins. Like, you know, like, we had a blast. And so anytime now that you hit me with some Kenny Loggins to start, I'm in. I'm 100% in. Like, it just makes me, that did lift my mood. The funny thing is, one of my first jobs ever, like real jobs, like, I don't know what you call it, a real job, but I used to work in the pro shop at Algonquian Regional Park in Loudoun County, Virginia. And woo boy, the stories we could tell. Working at a golf course is just wild. Like, you never know what is going to happen day to day.
Do you have anybody get into a fight on the golf course?
We had a fight, but we had like park rangers, and one of the guys, I probably could find him like just using his first name and the fact that he used to play like defensive end at Oklahoma. Mark.
Yeah, like you had like course marshals, because you said park rangers, and I just thought of like a guy in the Smokey the Bear costume running through the golf
like
course.
Not marshals like the old guys that check you in and drive along to like speed you up, because this was a regional park that had like campsites and
did have like Smokey the Bear guys.
The full, you know, and Mark was like the only one that looked like he could kick someone's ass if they needed to, whatever. But there was a guy who was probably conservatively 82 years old that would drive the range picker and constantly get it stuck, but he also would just like walk to the side of the range and like just go pee, and they're like, it was just, you're kind of like, you can't do that, they're gonna make people uncomfortable. We had
at 82, you know, he did not
give a shit. Yeah. We had people, my sister worked there too. She had a family that came in once. This guy was like yelling at her, like, you have to honor your commitments about this like coupon that he had. And she's like, sir, I don't know what to tell you. This is not our golf course. Like, this is some other course's coupon. Like, I don't know what you want. We had people that got married there. You could have made like a sitcom, like a weekly ABC sitcom, and just had like guest stars that were famous people come in and out of this thing. It was a disaster. I loved every second.
Go ahead, Spencer.
I have an unrelated question for Caroline.
Yes.
As a golf course expert, which you are now, and as a cineast, what parts of this were you watching and you're like, man, what were they doing? Like what parts of this aged poorly where you go, oh, this is a movie made in 1980 by a bunch of like coked up nerds?
So I will say the first part where I was like, oh, okay, was the open creepiness from Bill Murray, the like the ball machine. I chuckled, but also gross.
Like, yeah,
like loudly, like bark for me. That was
background, so the checks didn't exist in the 80s.
No, and the caddy,
didn't have to pass one.
The caddy, so we didn't, I mean, we weren't, it wasn't a country club. We didn't have caddies. We didn't bring your stuff in for you. It was a regional course. Like, you just paid. But otherwise, like, golf stuff wise, it really, like, that's probably the biggest thing, other than, you know, we didn't have like topless pool time, like the 1-to-115 caddy, like, cool takeover.
Yeah, it's something you notice about movies made in the from basically 78 to like 91 that at some point some really sweaty coked up Hollywood exec was like, I need some breasts, like, just for some
Why
reason
still wearing a top. And then this sex symbol of the movie, is her name actually Lacey Underbottoms? I know nobody's name.
Underhall
Yes.
She rolls up in the most like demure bathing suit that you possibly could for 1980. It's like not even high rise cut or anything. It's just like a very high coverage black one piece bathing suit. Mm-hmm. Like as they're doing all these other things, it's like very sexy and like this woman's topless and all these things. And she's like, ooh, this is my like one piece. Like, I don't know. It just cracked me up. I think I texted Kyle about it. 'Cause I was like, this is the caddy is in a Speedo. And our sex symbol is in like the most covered up one piece I've ever seen in my entire life.
The 80s were wild. To transition that into kind of the trivia and also just something that worked is the movie was inspired by Brian Doyle Murray, who's Bill Murray's brother. His memories working as a caddy in a golf club. His brother Bill and Harold Ramis also worked as caddies when they were teenagers. And it's like the thing about comedy is the best comedy is rooted in truth. Like I'm finally reading Jason's book, Hell's World Without You, which is wonderful. And knowing that all that is rooted in truth of his experiences makes everything much more fun, much more funny. And in Jason's book, much more like authentic and emotional, but like much, much more funny in general. And that's where this movie really shines in that, like Spencer said, like these people love golf and lived these experiences. Like they took something that was personal to them and integral in their upbringing and turned it into just 96 minutes of sketches and funny things. And we were talking beforehand that Chevy Chase's upbringing mirrors the life Ty is living, which is a life I could very much see myself being very interested in, and not having to work but having a lot of money and golfing every day. That's something that like I personally could vibe with. That seems like a lot of fun. Seems like something I could get down in.
I think that's what Chevy Chase did for like 15 years, like in the 90s up to like the 2000s.
I think the only difference though with Chevy Chase and Ty is that everyone either seems to generally like Ty or like Smails, like seeking his approval and stuff like that, whereas Chevy Chase spent his entire life seemingly being hated by everyone.
Just alienating everybody. Yeah.
Everyone hates Chevy Chase.
I heard that recently and I didn't know that, and that kind of makes me sad, but it also makes sense, so I kind of get it.
He's not like every him and Bill Murray, like that's part of this, like him and Bill Murray famously did not like each other while they were on SNL. This scene was, they realized that they did not have a scene in the movie. They wrote this one for that, or at least put them in a room and said, make something happen. But yeah, this, there are a lot of stories from like his time on Community.
Yeah, he did. There's only one scene where the two of them are together. That's it in the entire film.
And it's great. It's
great.
It's a lot of fun. A lot of quotable moments in that scene.
Oh, hi, Carl. How you doing?
Oh, hi.
Hi. Mind if I play through?
Sure, go right ahead. What are you, getting in a late night or something?
Yeah, I was just loosening up a bit.
Was that your ball I heard rambling through?
Yeah, did you see my ball?
Hello? Tie list?
That's it.
Yeah, it's right here.
This your place, Carl?
Yeah, what do you think?
They're pros. It's probably my favorite. It's probably my favorite scene with Carl in it. I'm not like, this is not, I think, among Bill Murray's best work. The guy who is the best in this movie is Ted Knight. Ted Knight is the best because the film does not work without him. Also, there's a scene where there's a lamp. This is my favorite kind of joke, that there's a lamp in the middle of the table and he's trying to talk to Danny and the lamp is between him and Danny.
Yes.
And Ted Knight, hey.
That is the funniest scene. I'm sorry.
where Ted Knight is just gradually getting more and more pissed off because he's already mad, and the lamp has become the focal point for that anger, and he just starts like trying to look around it, and then just swipes it off the desk completely. Oh, it's Ted Knight's so good,
and it works so well because Ted Knight was this generally beloved actor, but like an actor, like did TV, had a very by the book like solid career. And him being surrounded by all of this chaos, both like in general, how the movie was being made with the improvisation, and then his character generally being surrounded by chaos that he was deeply unfamiliar with, it works perfectly because Ted Knight was this regimented actor and Rodney Dangerfield is just doing everything off the cuff, both on screen and off screen. And it works flawlessly. Like Spencer, you're exactly right that this movie without Smails, if it was... I don't know who, but if it was another person who was kind of zany and kind of kooky in like a weird improv way, it doesn't work. Like this guy has to be completely regimented, extremely stiff, and believable that he would be driven crazy by any little speck of dust being out of order at his beloved country club, like the wax buildup on his shoes.
Yeah, I need them polished to a fine shine, which you could see the guy takes it and absolutely destroys his shoes when he hears him make an off-color racial joke. Yeah.
Yes, he does. Like,
I love that guy was when he doing all the betting at the end. He was one of my favorite. Like,
oh, look. The bookie. He just turns. Yeah. Like, you want to know who's actually in charge there? It's the bookie. Yeah. It's not anyone else.
Yeah. This bit of trivia I appreciated. To the end of his life, even though the film became better appreciated over time, Harold Ramis was dissatisfied with his directorial debut. Quote, "All I see are compromises and things we could have done better," he told GQ magazine in the late 2000s. His greatest complaint was that no one in the film other than Michael O'Keefe was able to swing his or her golf clubs properly. Which, like, Harold Ramis, you would have made an excellent guest on this podcast, because that is something in more serious movies I love to harp on, is you didn't get the sports right. Like, Legend of Bagger Vance, when you show up on the show, we're coming for you, because Matt Damon can't swing a golf club. And this movie, I don't think... For me, like, it doesn't take away from things at all that everyone, because, like, Smales is supposed to be bad at golf. Michael O'Keefe's swing just stands out as a thing of beauty. He looks like he can absolutely flush a golf ball, and it is really nice to watch him swing a club.
Yeah. Then Rodney Dangerfield was awful too.
That's also supposed to be awful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Again, off topic here, but related. Do you know how many guys put videos of themselves swinging a golf club in their dating app, like, profile?
I'd imagine quite that's a bit.
That's so good.
And do you know, then I sit there and I'm like, that swing's not very good. Like, I am not a pro by You're any like- stretch of the imagination. I have been in the 18 handicap range in my life. Like, I dabble. I have some good moments. But my grandmother, who taught me how to golf, has a hell of a swing, and I know that I have a good swing. So I sit there and I'm just like, you got to straighten that arm out. Ooh, that's you're going back too quick. You're trying to hit too hard.
That feels like a one-way trip to Ickville, though. Like, if the person has an ugly golf swing, it's like, nah.
Oh, 100%. And that's also the, like, it just, for some reason, this sucks, because I'm like, basically, like, it's nice you have a hobby. It's like, you know, that's nice you have a hobby. But it just makes me think, like, you're one of those people that if you get bored in a crowded room, you're just going to do the little, like, air swing, you know, like, mm-hmm. the half practice thing. And I get the ick. And it's
I feel attacked. I feel attacked.
You do the, you know, you link the hands and you're just like, oh yeah, let me stretch that out a little bit.
I work remotely, and I work in sales. And so I spend a lot of my time on the phone. And my number one reason I could not do sales in an office was because it would look really weird if I was on the phone and also had my putter and was doing my putting stroke. It would be very off-putting to everyone I worked with. So I'm stuck working remotely forever.
Yeah.
The last trivia thing, I encourage everyone to go look at the IMDb and go look. I think there's a great oral history on this too. Just a rich, rich text. Caroline, can you guess the noises, what the gopher makes? What animal those were sourced from?
A rat.
No. Those are from a dolphin. The same ones used in the movie Flipper from 1964.
Okay.
The
gopher being fully, like, animatronic fluff, like, stuffed animal, it just screams cocaine to me.
I mean, a lot of this movie
screams. Yeah, a lot of, like, yeah, like, to be fair.
To be fair.
To be fair, remember the guy who wrote it, Doug Kenny, was famously high on blow for like a decade before either killing himself or falling accidentally off the side of a Hawaiian cliffside, which happened shortly after this film was released.
I mean, that's the thing about movies in the 80s, though. Whenever you're hearing about, like, what's going on set or what's influencing the script, it's just 9 times out of 10. It's just, I mean, like, Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, like, Days of Thunder, Top Gun, just cocaine, baby. Just nothing but cocaine energy.
Just remember, Days of Thunder, the movie where somebody is in fourth gear, the last gear that a NASCAR machine has, and then says, I'm dropping the hammer, and shifts into fifth. That's my favorite, is if, like, they're going 203 miles an hour at Daytona, and Coulter goes, I'm dropping the hammer. Nope, no, you're not. Another gear, brother.
That's cocaine, though. Like, hey, Don, he doesn't have another gear. We'll make one.
Yeah.
We can always find another gear.
How Fast and the Furious was born.
Hey, Fast and the Furious, at least in terms
art,
the car's specs, not their behavior, not how they can fly on cables like acrobat. No, as far as the cars actually being things that could exist.
True. This is true. Yes, this is true.
Caroline, I'll kick to you as far as what worked about this movie. What did you enjoy? Things we haven't discussed yet. Because I'm very curious off first watch, because it's a lot, especially with comedies, you're trying to remember bits and it's what makes you laugh. But like, what flowed about this one?
There's a few. I actually, as much as I think that what doesn't work is also a bit of Bill Murray's character, I think I laugh the most with some of his, just like, so when he was saying that he was a Cinderella boy,
the Augusta speech.
I don't want, he's just like, and he just kept saying like the distances were like not much closer and the clubs were all wrong. But particularly when he's in that dump of a house with Chevy Chase and he says, oh, this is where you live. And he goes, yeah, you like it? Like, what do you think? I don't know why that made me laugh so hard. I think it does well doing the skit idea. Like, because you, when you described it as that, Kyle, it really, I think, hit it on the head, because it's a series of like slightly connected things where each little bit is like, you've got the pool skit, you've got the like the country club party skit, you've got the big golf match skit. Like, it works, I think, in that format is great, because you kind of just move to the next thing and it keeps it clipping along for a crisp 96 or whatever it is.
Yeah. Movies that their majority of their mission is just let funny people cook, it doesn't always work, but this one works pretty much the entire time because there's enough there. And like, the talent they have with Dangerfield, like if Dangerfield is your thing, which I love watching Rodney Dangerfield do literally anything, like that works tremendously. Bill Murray, when you just drop him in and say, hey man, be funny. I think that's done the best in Kingpin, because in Kingpin they just let him, no script, just let him go. And that is one of my favorite Bill Murray performance. It might be my favorite. I think it's just incredible.
That one, he's Ernie McCracken in that one.
McCracken. I mean, Bill Murray in Kingpin is like, give him an EGOT. Just for that performance.
It's the sleaziest performance I've ever seen in my life.
Like, I need to rewatch it, because I've only seen it once and it was with two of my like best friends from my crew, one of my crews, and they had seen it 1 billion times. And so they did the like kind of saying everything with it and then like nudging each other when like the funny parts were coming up. And so it was a tough watch to do that for your first one, but I definitely laughed at Ernie McCracken. Like, was
when he's talking to the press and they ask him about that paternity suit and he's like, oh no, it's not. So it's like, I pulled out her way earlier, whatever he says. It's just,
yeah. And, like, in a similar vein, my favorite part of this movie remains Rodney Dangerfield. Like, Ted Knight is obviously the backbone. Everything works because of him. But Rodney Dangerfield's wrongest lines are, to me, the treasure I keep coming back to. When he's dancing with, he cuts in on Schmale's wife and says, do you want to make $14 the hard way? That's so wrong. It's so good. When he looks at her and says, you must have been something before electricity. Like, this is a man who should be slapped in every single scene.
That one.
Yeah. If you watch it again, and eventually, once you recover from watching it once, you probably will watch it again. Right?
Probably something before electricity.
I mean, at one point he says, he called me a baboon. He thinks I'm his wife.
He's so good. And he's the perfect foil to Smales, because he's the first person in this guy's life, at least in the last 20 years, that has not, like, Smales is clearly disliked by everyone, but put up with by everyone because of his status and his money. And he's too Smails doesn't understand that Ty just wants nothing to do with him. Like those like very small put downs have, you know, fly completely over his head. Cervic is the first person that Smails has not been able to bully into obedience. And it drives him. It's why he takes the bet at the end. It's why he takes the match to begin with. It's why he takes the double or nothing bet that he doesn't have to do because he's already at the very least tied. And it drives him crazy that his money and influence in this club just bounces off this man like rubber. And it's the best, the oil and water mixing of Smails and Cervic just drives this movie. It's so good.
It's the added too of like that Rodney Dangerfield is so audibly and visibly offensive to everything that the judge holds like sacred and proper. And like, that's how you first, it's not just the outfits and the music and the insults to his wife. It's the condos next to the golf course. It's the physical manifestation of, so it's absolutely all the stuff where it's like, no, he's not deferring to him for the first time and he doesn't have that control over him, but it's also the way that he's doing it. That's like everything he holds sacred is the status he has at the golf course. And like, that's his place where everyone follows the damn rules and does everything the right way. And this guy's not only doing that, doing it loudly and aggressively, but people love him for it, it seems, or like enjoy doing it with him. And it's like it just feels like when people are like, millennials are eating too much avocado toast, or not enough avocado toast apparently, because we're not going out to eat enough now, I think is what people are saying. But I don't know if that makes any sense. I'm tired.
No, Al is the only one consistently having 100% fun. And he's only at the golf course. And tell Smails this: I hate this place. It's a snobatorium. It sucks. I'm only here because I might buy it.
Yes. And so he not only shits all over the place this guy loves so much, he just is like, I'm. he thinks he's above it, which is even more insulting.
He tells him, I'm gonna take away the one thing you love in life.
Yeah, because I don't care. You know?
I'm going to bulldoze it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how to sail, and I'm not going to buy a sailboat. I'll buy the biggest, ugliest boat I can find. I'll turn it into a beer barge, and I'll crash into your boat with it, because you're a dinosaur, and I'm the asteroid. Like, that's... I love Rodney Dangerfield's character so much in this film, from that, and from walking into the pro shop, and with his Asian friend of indeterminate like nationality when he walks in and goes, hey, Wang, don't tell him you're Jewish.
Yeah, I can't park my car, get my bags, and put on some weight, will you? Hey, Wang, what's with the pictures? It's a parking lot. Come on, will you?
I think this place is restricted, Wang, so don't tell me you're Jewish. Okay, fine.
Hey, kid, I'm Al Chervik. I'm playing with Drew Scott today. This is my guest, Mr. Wang. No offense. Oh, I can maybe have a half a dozen of those Vulcan D10s and set my friend up here with the whole schmear. You know, clubs, bags, shoes, gloves, shirt, pants. Hey, orange balls. I'll have a box of those. Give me a box of those naked lady tees and give me two of those. Give me six of those. Oh, this is the worst looking hat I ever saw. Well, you buy a hat like this, I'll bet you get a free bowl of soup, huh? Oh, it looks good on you, though.
When he insults the hat and the hand of the wearing it.
If you buy this hat, you get a free bowl of soup with it. And he looks, and like, I love the kind of telegraphed humor that you get in like classic Borscht Belt, Mel Brooks kind of shit. And I love it because you go, oh, please let Judge Smails be over there wearing the hat. And it flashes over and he's wearing the hat.
That kind of stuff will be funny to me till the day I die.
It's the best. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Oh, God, who would wear this? I'd kick my own ass.
Looks good on you, though. And
looks good on
you, and Spencer, amidst all these wacky characters and general comedic geniuses, like very famous people, at the center of this all, we have Danny, played by kind of relative unknown Michael O'Keefe. And I like that Danny is not just our like a naive, innocent hero who we're really rooting for. Like, Danny's capable. He's understanding. He's willing to take big risks. Danny's very self-aware. He is just not this character that we're like, oh, he's in this world he doesn't understand. Like, Danny understands everything that's going on around him. And his whole goal is to, I'm caddying at this place to get myself out of my absolutely crowded house.
Mm-hmm. And in the end decides it's not worth it.
There's a billion people in that house.
Yeah.
I want one of those caddy hats. Like, mm-hmm. yes, those things are cool. It took me an embarrassing long amount of time to realize I knew that this movie was called Caddyshack. Obviously, my entire life, I had heard of this. I had just hadn't seen it. It took until they showed the thing that said Caddyshack for me to be like, oh, it's the shack where the caddies. I don't know what I thought.
It's a great name. It's a great golf movie.
It's really good. I just really enjoyed all of the caddy interactions.
Mm-hmm. Because they have an upstairs downstairs thing.
Yeah.
You hear what you hear it's a little bit like an English class drama where you hear what like everyone on the course is saying and they're just like complete vapid idiots. And then you hear what everyone in the caddy shack is saying or what the caddies are saying. And like they're all just like, I need weed. Let's make a bet. Like
what does he say? Do you do drugs? He's like, every day.
Every day.
Good.
And he tells him, Good boy, Danny. Good boy.
I just even loved when he had like the coke behind when he was in the caged in door, whatever. And he's like, mm-hmm. Oh, I can't give you your paycheck. The guy's not here. Oh, a coke's a 50 cents now, like whatever. And then immediately the boss gets back. He's like, get out of here. And he does the like shuffle out. He's like, hey, so how's it going?
Yeah.
They get into that stupid fight and knock over the gumball. Mm-hmm.
Caroline, how'd you feel about the golf fashion in this movie? Because this is, to me, this is where golf fashion peaked. They've been posting a lot of pictures from like the Masters in the late 70s, early 80s this week. And it's incredible stuff. And then it really, really devolved in the 90s.
The women in this movie, I think the outfits are pretty good. I think that the late 70s, early 80s, like they have, I love the high-waisted jeans. I love that. That's all very cute. Every single thing a man wears in this movie is hideous. Like, without exception. The pants, the cut of everything, the material, the giant lapels, it's all just the patterns. Oh my God, the Rodney Dangerfield outfits. Like, I know that's part of the thing, the loud outfits, but what was it? He had the like purple plaid jacket and the red pants on at the dinner thing or whatever. And he stood up and I saw the pants and I was like, oh my God, what are we doing? It was a look.
The full button down long sleeve golf shirts are really funny. And it's even funnier because there was that time, this had to be within the last 10 years, that Phil Mickelson randomly showed up to a tournament wearing what looked like just like business casual, just wearing a long sleeve button down, which was the most absolute Phil Mickelson shit ever.
Sounds about right.
But really, really delightful. Caroline, I'll let you kick off here. Does anything not work about this movie?
It's just kind of mayhem. I didn't love the animatronic gopher. I'm just going to say it. I'm sorry. I apologize.
It's a bold take.
I know. I just, like, it dancing, I think, is what put me over the edge. Like, I don't know why, though. I don't think, maybe it was the crankiness today. But I was like, why is it dancing? Why is it? I don't know. Otherwise, I mean, this is hard. This is a hard one to be overly critical about because it is what it is. Like, it's a funny comedy that hits the notes it needs to. I lied. I do have one big question. How old is the woman supposed to be? Because I think that the age range of the people that she is sleeping with this in this movie is very large, and that made me a little uncomfortable. Like, it's 17, maybe.
I mean, look at it this way. If anything, that's progressive given everything else in the movie. That the woman is the one who we're like, he's a little young, don't you think? Like, that's about as close to the Caddyshack gets as like, oh, we'll flip quality. Gender roles. Yeah, no, like, it's kind of a sleaze. It's like, there are definitely sleazy sexist angles in this movie. I don't think that's one.
Yeah. All right, fair. I'll let it go.
Something as far as not working that we haven't yet talked about Maggie and her Irish accent. So there was a piece of trivia that according to the original script and specials on the making of the movie, the character Maggie is an exchange student from Ireland. This explains her thick accent, which goes unexplained in the final movie. Because it goes unexplained, it's like, that's not great. It's
I also don't think it was very consistent, was it? Like,
no, well, she was not Irish. So that actress, Sarah Holcomb, she's also in Animal House. She's very like tragic story after this. She got deep into drugs, started suffering. I think she started suffering from schizophrenia. Now lives under an assumed name elsewhere. But the whole Maggie plot is again like trying to give Danny some extra conflict, trying to give they also have sex after he plays a round of golf, which you rarely feel more gross than after a round of golf.
Yes, but remember, everyone's on drugs, so this really makes sense.
It does. That does add up. And then they have the pregnancy plot, which is resolved in maybe 4 minutes of screen time.
Mere minutes. Yes.
That's a part of Danny Noonan's no good, very bad, horrible day. That 24 hours. Spencer, does anything about this movie not work for you?
That subplot does not work. Harold Ramis is right. They could have done a lot of things better. It is part of its charm is that it's a ramshackle movie, but there's also parts where you go, oh man, it looks like they shot this on toilet paper. Like, I'm sure studio heads who got the dailies back were like, we're never getting that Coke money back.
No,
we're never. Like, it is kind of a sloppy, amateurish movie. I know people love Bill Murray in this. I don't particularly love Bill Murray a lot in this one. I don't want to watch him bark like a dog at old ladies. And in addition to that, I think that in terms of what they get Chevy Chase to do, I think he actually doesn't have enough to do. I don't think they gave him great lines. And I think that's because in part, he's another person overshadowed by Rodney Dangerfield in this movie. Like, once they got Rodney out there, it was a bull in a china shop. And I think they realized that.
I mean, he comes out of this a star.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I thought he was going to be in it more, if we're going to be honest. Like, I was kind of like, where'd he go? Is he in this? Is this just like, is that the only thing that we get from him?
Yeah. You could just tell that, like, the lack of a script means that they had these beats and they're not real fleshed out. So when they have to do any plot or actual golf things, like, it gets kind of sloppy. It's a sloppy movie. It's part of its charm. But at times you're like, oh man, y'all, come on. You could have done a second take.
Yeah.
I'm not asking for 15 takes. I'm asking for a second take.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've done a second take.
Caroline, yeah. I was,
whatever you see is the thing that they watched and were like, yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, sure. Next.
This is the one that makes it in.
Yeah.
Caroline, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on how much like legal exposure that Al Cervic has, specifically with the entire boat scene, but this man's attorney must be just racking up the build hours.
A busy person. Yeah, I think easily $100,000 in damage done with the boat.
At least. I mean, because it's not just Smales' stuff. Like, he is a menace. No. I can't imagine anyone else in that lake is taking that sitting down.
No, there's probably whatever that, like, fleet of five small ships that he, like, pushes through. He breaks the attorney's got to deal with whatever legal issue is going to come up from if there's, like, park police or something. For breaking every like wake rule probably in that lake as well. It's a busy person, I think.
Yeah. Has to
and be. I feel badly forever has to clean the vomit out of the car that was thrown up in by the kid who threw up through the
like good old Spalding who's having quite the time.
Was the worst.
My father used to say the line, you'll get nothing and like it.
Yes, so did mine. I was like, oh shit, okay, is this where he got this? Yeah.
Spalding absolutely worked in the Trump administration. Let's take a quick ad break and then we'll get back with best scene.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Spencer, what's the best scene in this movie?
The best scene in this film is Rodney Dangerfield rolling into the pro shop for the first time. Like when Al Chervik comes in and you're just like, oh man, this is a crass asshole. I cannot wait to watch this man work for the next like 83 minutes.
From the second he's on screen, he's on absolute fire. Just every single minute, he's perfection.
Yes. So that's it. Like the film's pretty good, and then Dangerfield hits the screen, and it's rocket fuel whenever he's on there. Yeah,
I really do like the dancing scene on the golf course. I don't know. I know that's not like a full scene. That one cracks me up.
It's like right after he shows up. Just an extended Dangerfield show from that point on.
And I also still really like the like you said, the below deck, the downstairs when they follow the golf at the end, they're doing all the betting. Love that. Like, I don't know what it is, but it just gave me, it did. Cause like, I worked at the golf course. I've worked at like as a server, like it just gave me early job vibes of like you against the rich people you're serving, even though in that case, like I wasn't serving a bunch of rich people at Olive Garden or like, but you were the workers and the other people were the ones enjoying the fun, and you kind of lived in this middle like gray area, kind of observing everything. I like that a lot.
Yeah. Mine is another Dangerfield one is the dinner and all the lines we already talked about, the tigers eating their young and just him working.
He gets
the
meanest lines off. Like that's when, you know, you want to make $14 the hard way.
on that subject, what's the best quote in this movie? We've dropped a ton. Spencer, what's the if you had to pick one?
For me, it's the last time I saw a mouth like that, it had a hook in it. Yeah. And there's like several contenders for that, including the aforementioned $14 one. But that one, it's right there, followed with a close second by I've sent boys younger than you to the electric chair. Or the gas chamber. I can't remember exactly which method of execution it is. Yeah,
the gas chamber. I owed it to them.
If you understand and abide by the rules of decent society. Danny. There's a lot of, badness in the world today. I see it in court every day. I've sentenced boys younger than you to the gas chamber. Didn't want to do it. Because I owed it to them.
Yes.
That's probably it for me, but I will say I am always tickled by rat farts. Just always lightning hits him or rat farts, boom, lightning strike.
Mm-hmm.
Caroline, did you have a favorite?
I actually really liked, for some reason, really liked that scene. The guy like having his best round and then getting struck by lightning. We didn't even talk about that. I think I can't remember what the actual like. Oh. I don't think the heavy stuff's going to come down for quite a while.
That's the best Carl scene, because he is the perfect guy for, I'm going to leave a corpse on the course and just skedaddle. Like that's.
I definitely like thought, I don't know. I don't think the hard stuff's going to come down for a while. And I got really cracked up when he did the whole like, you like it? And Chevy Chase is like, I can't sit. I don't want to stick to anything in here.
their whole scene together, like the whole thing could be up for best quote. I love when Chevy is like, you know, can I get a ruling on this? Like his balls in Carl's shack. It's just
like in his spoon. Just open a window and play through.
Mm-hmm. It's so good. Okay, let's wrap with best time, worst time, because we're not going to do before Morris Door, because this movie has an absolutely terrible sequel. It's pretty much despised by everyone, Caroline. Which character has the best time? I think which character has the best time in this movie is extremely obvious.
Al Chervik. Yeah.
Yeah. That one's easy. Done.
As far as which character has the worst time, it's kind of obvious that it's Smails, but the 24 hours between the second Smails walks into the bedroom to see Danny and Lacey, because at that point he's like, he's been chased around a house by a man with a golf club or with like a lamp or whatever. He thinks he has thrown away his chance at that scholarship and all that brown nosing he did to Smails. He's having an oops baby with Maggie, the Irish exchange student, and thinks he now has to get married. It's as dark a 24 hours as you can get.
Tough stretch for that kid. He's thinking about how he's getting stuck at home with them. There were so many kids in that house, dude. Way too many people in the house. And he put so much sugar in his cereal. I cannot get over that. In his Cheerios. Mm-hmm. Did he put sugar in Cheerios?
It might have been cocaine.
Could have been coke, yeah.
Could have been or cocaine. PC.
If you go back and look, 1980, if you go back and look at self-reported drug use, the class of 1980 is the highest reported self-reported drug use of any high school graduating class ever. People will say, well, that doesn't mean they did the drugs. And I'm like, it's the aspiration that counts, because like the numbers of like high school seniors in 1980 who said they had done PCP is insane. It's like 32%. I'm like, that's 31% too many.
That's like how much of Rocky IV was montages.
Yeah.
Right. That's if you're 18, you don't need to even know what PCP is.
1980 was part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
Spencer, we're gonna bid you adieu here. Tell the folks again where they can follow you, where they can check out Channel 6.
You can check out Channel 6. It is in my Twitter bio. You can also just Google Channel 6 Spencer Hall. Hey, that's another way to do it, because it's channel6.ghost.io, but you'll find it. Two things a week, absolutely exceptional value, if I may say so myself. Subscribe today. We have a free edition too. You can just subscribe for the free one. But Holly Anderson and I produce two things a week. Tomorrow we'll be doing the Big Ten vibe checks, which is, I don't know when this is coming out, but it'll be in your inbox if you like. You can also find me on the Shutdown Fullcast. I just did an Unlapped on ESPN because I do F1 stuff for them as well. And I think that's it for this week.
It's the best money I spend all year. And sir, we're deeply grateful that you could join us tonight.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You got it. All right. Me and Caroline are back. Caroline, the Lenny Harris Pinch Hitter Award for Best Supporting Character, which is an interesting dynamic in this movie, because almost everyone is a supporting character.
Yeah.
Danny's obviously in it too much.
Yeah.
Rodney Dangerfield's in it too much, and I would say Judge Smails is definitely in it too much.
Eileen Chevy Chase?
You can make a strong argument if he counts, it's him. It'd be between him or Bill Murray. I think is the two like strong, like you could say like D'Annunzio, the caddy, like he's a supporting character, obviously Lacey Underall, but I think Chevy Chase, like Bill Murray, Carl is, I think, the more iconic character. Like people talk about him more and do that. Yeah. But everything Chevy Chase says in this movie is funny.
It was very funny. Yeah, I think it's Chevy Chase. I don't think he's, because like I said, I for a while was like, is he coming back? Like,
yeah, we get him. He's in the beginning when Danny's caddying for him. He has the scene, meets Lacey at the dinner, and then has her over to her house. They make the bet with Smails, and then they have the match at the end. And the scene with Carl.
Yeah. Yeah, but, I think. Yeah. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go with that.
Overthink it. You know,
defend the villain. Villain in this. So here's the thing.
Who is the villain?
That's the thing. Smails is obviously a villain. He's a bad person. He has sentenced young men to the gas chamber.
Yes.
I don't think there's any defenses. I think it's just like money and power rots, I think would be your defense of Smails. Cervic is interesting.
Well, for Smails, you could also be like, this loud, brash fella has come into his sanctuary. So how else would, you know, as he sees his whole domain falling apart. So this is why he acts the way he does.
That's true.
Defended. Boom. Lawyered.
Cervic is you know, he's got this money in this, which gives him power now to like act this way, but he doesn't strike me as a guy who was very buttoned up before he got money.
No, it feels very new money.
It's definitely new money.
Yeah, it is new money. It doesn't feel new money, but the vibes are like, it's just a typical reaction, I think, to coming into a large sum of money if you're not used to it. And it's the flashy outfits and the feeling emboldened to just kind of do whatever you want to do, because what are they going to do to you? What are they going to say?
Yeah. That's exactly it. That's exactly the defense of him. Is anyone going to say anything to you?
What are you going to do about it?
The Peter Gallagher Award for the hottest person in this movie.
I am on record as saying this is not a very hot movie.
You are. You have texted that. It is in the record. It is in the going to the Library of Congress.
I do think I was a little overly critical of Lacey early. The first scene where she's flirting with Chevy is not, well, the dress looks, I mean, she looks great in that. So I just,
she
the
does.
Makeup, it was a weird makeup look for her, weird lighting.
Mm-hmm.
She's beautiful. I think it has to be her.
I think it's her. I think it's very interesting that Chevy goes from like pretty, I would say like good looking in this period, if that's what you're into, to he's Clark Griswold right after this. He turns right into Clark Griswold.
I honestly do, like the beginning of the movie, you get flashes of like, is Chevy Chase handsome? And then by the end, it feels like he's morphed into Griswold already. I don't know. Like it's a weird, he's an interesting cat. Obviously it's not, I don't know. Like, it's just not a hot movie, guys. It's a very 80s, like, all the grossness of the intentional grossness, and not like, I'm not making like physical comments or anything on these, but the way that they have the caddies, especially the male caddies, like act. D'Annunzio is pretty hot. I'll give him that. He's like 80s villain hot.
80s villain hot. The constant cigarette sticking out of the mouth.
Yeah. It's like if Ralph Macchio was the bad guy in Karate Kid.
That's actually a good pull.
That's like the vibe I got. It's like if the Karate Kid like broke bad and is now like this smarmy bad guy. But all of the, like, it's supposed to be the physical humor. It's the, you know, jeans in the pool and the like, where they do the things with the belly, and you know, it just, there's all the like body humor, it feels like. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but it's just not, overall, it's not a what did we do that was a very Palm Springs Peter Gallagher Award initiator.
Yes.
Very good. We've done a lot of movies that were very good looking that was difficult to pick for other reasons.
Yeah, we did. We had a like a long stretch where it was like, oh, everyone in this movie's good looking.
Yeah.
The 80s just aren't about that, you know?
No, they are not. Especially not early 80s.
No.
It's weird because I think the 70s have the pot. This is why, I don't know why I'm going on this diatribe. Here we go. Welcome, folks. If you're still here, I feel like the 70s have way more of a chance to have like a sexy vibe to them. Like late 70s.
Yeah. I mean, the 70s were just generally sexier. And I feel like in this 80s, everyone just got like sweaty and coked out. And bloated.
It's
like
it's weird because like it's not a necessarily like a fabric thing. It's not a patterns and fabrics thing, because that was still bad in the late 70s, but there was just something like the vibes in the late 70s compared to the early 80s feel so different to me. I don't know what it is.
Speaking of weird vibes, the Keith Morrison Dateline episode from this movie,
boy do I have one for you.
Oh, can't wait
to play on this bad boy. Hold on, before I start, just make sure I get it right. It's Bushwood.
Bushwood.
I was like, I thought it was the more immature version. And I was like, it's not brushwood. Okay, Bushwood. From the outside, Bushwood Golf Course looked like the heaven it tried to show you. It was beautiful, sweeping greens and fairways. But underneath, did it lie something more deadly? Maybe murder? Everything seemed normal till one day a body turned up on the 18th green. Was it natural causes? Or was it something more malicious? Then you add in the complaints from young ladies on the course and odd near-death experiences with rogue bullet shots. What was happening at Bushwood? And would it lead to murder tonight on Dateline?
That's very good. Ritzy exclusive clubs make for good true crime murder.
Oh, mysteries. Yeah, absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
Everyone has secrets to hide at Bushwood.
Yes. What was lurking just below the surface at Bushwood tonight on Dateline?
What kind of legal exposure do we think Carl is looking at the end of the movie?
Ooh,
like
buddy.
I think I surmised in the book that he probably has to go on the run. Like there's no, and 1980 is still a time where you can go on the run. Like Carl probably yeah. doesn't have much of a, like a paper track record. Cause I'm looking at Carl and I'm like, probably served in Vietnam. He's pretty familiar with that C4. He's a little damaged. Carl might just like pick up, move five states over, hop on a new course. They're not doing a background check. And that might be
most,
it.
For most part, that's enough.
Like, yeah, that's all you got
to
do.
So my sister and I went to go see Rear Window. At
For
Alamo.
Some reason, I thought you were about to say my sister and I actually skipped five states over.
Did this once. This is what I'm going to tell you. I'm not who I say I am. No, we went to see Rear Window at Alamo. Have you seen Rear Window?
Yes, I have, with Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, phenomenal movie.
Can you do a Jimmy Stewart?
Of course. Hold on, now I'm laughing and now I'm going to be like... So one of my favorite lines, it's way funnier than I remembered, but he's talking to the detective who comes to, like, you know, hear his little story about how this, and the detective has talked to the neighbors. He's like, yeah, well, and they said that it's a real quiet couple, keeps themselves, like no one really got to know them. and he goes, well, I feel like they missed their chance with her. Because she's dead. And then there's the detective is looking through and he sees the dancer in the apartment across the whatever, and he has this like real creepy smile start going, and he's like, Tom, how's your wife? We're laughing so hard. It's a very anti-marriage movie, because like I forgot that, like,
I think that's Alfred Hitchcock in general.
He wants to go back to his photography job, and like he's constantly being like, I don't want to get married, but what am I gonna do with Lisa? She's gonna wear all these skirts and high heels to India. Like he can't. But I'm like, sir, that is Grace freaking Kelly. Shut your trap. She is stunning. It's unbelievable how beautiful she is. Like, she's fantastic in that movie. And she's just like running around with her little like kitten heels, and it was so scandalous, like, because it came out in 54, that she had her little like Mark Cross suitcase with her like nightgown and was gonna stay the night. And
gonna like, stay the night, frisky.
Yeah, and it was just so, you know, that doesn't happen with a and but the whole time he was like aggressively being like, well, I'm not gonna marry you. Why would I marry you? Like, look what happens when you get married. The wives nag. Like, look, this is why she's dead. She nagged him. Like, you know, but it was great. We had such a good time, and it was we got confirmation today they're going to show Alien.
Ooh,
so excited!
How did we get here from Carl?
Because we were talking about. Oh, okay. So. In the movie, I was like, it's 1954. They can't arrest you for shit. Like,
no, you can't proof. Catch anyone. Yeah.
They have no proof about anything. If they don't have the proof, like hitting them in the, if they don't catch you actually doing it, see ya.
Didn't happen. There's no computers. Yeah. There's no proof of anything.
Dude just sent a postcard from his dead wife and was like, see, she made it upstate. Everything's good to go. And I love that Raymond Burr played the across the street neighbor who then went on to play Perry Mason, a show that I watched frequently as a child.
I can believe that. Yeah. roster moves. Who do we replace as Air Bud here? I feel like the obvious one is Al Cervic. If Air Bud is the bombastic, obnoxious condo developer.
Yes. I don't think it would be super funny with Bill Murray.
No. What if he's Judge Smales and he barks the line about sending boys to the gas chamber?
Subtitles. I think it is Dangerfield. Although I don't want to take out the, like, you know, energy that he brings.
He'd be deeply cute if he was just a caddy and, like, you found a way to, like, hitch a golf bag to him and he was just... Although if he's D'Annunzio... If he's D'Annunzio and he has the two golf bags over, like, on either side, and he's also smoking a cigarette and getting very upset with the old couple.
Oh, that was hilarious. No, any of them. Just let him go out and chase golf balls. He's perfect.
Well, Caroline, that wraps it, because before More Restored, this movie has a terrible sequel. A lot of the people involved are now dead. So, Harold Ramis passed away. Rodney Dangerfield has passed away. I don't think Bill Murray and Chevy Chase will ever get in another room together. So that I think this, and like, this is one, like, the sequel is an obvious cash grab. I think Rodney Dangerfield makes like a small appearance. Like, it was basically like, hey man, have some money. No one else.
Yeah.
This is one of those things, the kind of comedies that it's like such lightning in a bottle that just recreating it is very difficult. Yeah. Like, this stuff is more done. Sequels to movies like this, like in the 80s, like the sequel to Caddyshack is like Ghostbusters. It's like all these people getting together again to do something else. That's kind of, it's like how the Apatow movies, a lot of them didn't really have sequels, but it was just like, hey, all those guys that you thought were really funny, guess what? They're in another movie about something else. That's kind of how this is done. There's no, I think this one is encased in amber. You're not touching it.
Yeah, I don't, that's no reason to do. Now, I do think that there is potential. Like, I'm not even kidding. I still think it would make a really good sitcom to have.
A golf course? Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Now, golf is, I was fortunate enough to talk to Ron Shelton, who directed Bull Durham and Tin Cup. I think it was the end of 2022. And then I recently talked about this on No Laying Up's Trap Draw podcast about Tin Cup. And that the reason there are not many golf movies is because golf is very hard to film. It's very hard when you're renting out the space. It's not like a basketball movie or baseball movie in closed space. You know, you've got a huge golf course. So that's why there are just generally fewer movies. It's obvious. It's honestly like an incredible accomplishment that they took it. The two of the best golf movies ever are this and Happy Gilmore, and they decided to film on golf courses and like do the ambition of filming golf, because golf can go poorly. In movies, there are some really bad golf movies, but I love this one. I'm very glad you watched it.
Yeah, it was a fun watch. Good. Again, a crisp 96, you know,
crisp, like, 96, which is about where this episode will probably check out once I put clips in. So Caroline, tell the folks where they can find For the Water Cooler.
Anywhere you get your podcast, folks. You can get it every Wednesday. It'll show up in your podcast feed. Like I said, we had Matt's friend Wes was on this week, and then we'll have Anish Shroff of ESPN and the Carolina Panthers, he's the play-by-play for the Panthers, on when this one drops. So a couple days after this episode drops, you'll be able to hear that one. So it's been a ton of fun. I'll give my last 24 update next week.
Sad
poor one out,
end of an era.
But I've got a new show that, new is a relative term, because it is a rewatch, but Hulu was like, you might want to watch this, and I was like, you know what, Hulu, I do. So
what is it? Have you told me and Ryan what it is yet?
No, not yet. Timeless. Have you seen Timeless?
No, I've never even, I thought when you said Timeless, I thought you were saying that the show itself is timeless.
No, it's called Timeless. It's got what is her, it's not Breslin, that's the wrong Abigail. So Matt Lanter is one of the guys, and he does the voice work in one of the popular like Star Wars animated series. Abigail Spencer is her name. I think you'd recognize her if you saw her. Goran Vishnik says.
I just know that this is another show you're choosing to watch that's not The Bear.
Yeah, absolutely, because this one's enjoyable and doesn't make me want to like cry. Just kidding. I have cried a couple times, but not for like feeling like I'm getting yelled at. Star Wars The Clone Wars is what he does the voice of Anakin. Okay. So Matt is the voice of Anakin. Essentially, it's a time travel show. We all love a time travel show. Goran Vishnik, who was in ER for several seasons, steals a time machine and is going back in time, and they have to chase him through. She's a historian, he's a Marine, and then the third guy, Rufus, who is played by Malcolm Barrett, is the like guy who works at the facility where the time machine came from, and he's the pilot. And so they have to like go and try and stop them from interrupting history. And it's like they go back to like the Hindenburg and when President Lincoln is shot, and it's really cool because like they geek out over, I just watched an episode where they met the author of James Bond,
Ian Fleming.
Yeah, who was an actual MI6 undercover spy in Nazi Germany. So they take real historical moments and then like drop them in. And so like they're from the future and having read Ian Fleming books that he hasn't written yet, like that kind of stuff. It's just really, it's a delightful, funny, dramatic romp, if you will. I like it. I've seen the first season. It got canceled after like two seasons, and then they like did a thing where they brought it back, and I think they did like a timeless like movie to like close it all out. And so I haven't seen all that, but it's a nice background noise. And it's cute. It's fun. I would recommend it to the mother of the person that emailed the show this week.
Well, I wish you well. I wish you well in this endeavor. And I thank you for joining on Caddyshack. Big thanks to Spencer Hall for joining. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you want to pick movies for the show to cover, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/bigscreensports. And go pre-order my book, Movies with Balls, the Greatest Sports Films of All Time, Analyzed, Mapped, and Illustrated, available wherever books are sold. And we will catch you next week. Thanks for listening.